Welcome back, people, to Tell It Anyway, a storytelling podcast. This week, we have with us Jackie Vleck.
Hi.
Jackie Vleck is a writer and a producer who has written two shorts for James Franco's Rabbit Bandini films. The first of those is called Almost Not Beautiful and stars House of Cards' Kate Mara and General Hospital's Amber Tamblyn, I know. The second one is called American History, starring James Franco and Zachary Gordon, which is currently in post. Jackie is also the second graduate of Syracuse University to be featured on this podcast. Woo! In as many weeks. So take that, GW. So welcome, Jackie.
Hi, hello.
And also with us this week, we have Fred Goss. And Fred Goss is an actor, writer, director, and a tremendous improvisational performer. Now, for those of you listening at home, it's okay to admit that when you hear all those titles, a little part of your brain might go, yeah, sure, but let me tell you otherwise. Fred made his professional acting debut on ALF. Is this correct? Is this
on true? ALF, yes. Yeah, that is absolutely true.
That is amazing.
And that's all anybody ever cares about, because it never got better than that.
It's just instant cred. It's instant 80s amazing cred.
Got that clip, and I'm delivering alpha ventriloquist dummy.
Fred went on to write and act in the Bravo series Significant Others, which is actually really important to me and Matt.
Wrote in the sense that it was all improvised.
Yes.
Very organic improvised show. We had no idea what was going on.
Yeah.
Ever.
That's the best kind. And you also produced and acted and wrote in the ABC comedy Sons and Daughters, which
created, directed most of them.
Yeah.
It was a lot.
That was your bait.
Busy 10 months.
Yeah.
Yes.
He has since directed episodes of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, Marry Me, Community, Happy Endings, all your favorite shows, and the late and lamented, perhaps only by this family, Bad Teacher. Unless you think, sure, what has he really done? Fred Goss has directed Prince.
Yeah, but I haven't directed Broad City.
That's the shortcoming.
I would rather do that.
My prince, I do mean his purple royal majesty. So I can't start a podcast about storytelling without just briefly asking you what happened when you directed Prince.
Everybody had such an opinion. Everybody knows somebody who's worked with Prince, and it's always he stormed out, or he got mad, or he did one take and he left. It's all bull. Like he wasn't the friendliest guy, but he was totally professional.
That is awesome.
He thought I was a geek.
How did you?
I literally gave him a salutation on the second day. I went, Prince, and I waved my arm, and he rolled his eyes and walked by me.
Question is, how, when you have to give him a note or speak to him, do you say, excuse me, Mr. Prince?
He was great, because he would go, Fred. And he talks so quietly. You have to get really close to him. And he's like, instead of doing that line of dialogue, I'd like to play the guitar on the sofa when she comes out trying on clothes. And I'm like, I'm not even going to ask Liz, because if you want to fucking sit and play the guitar, Prince, ain't nobody going to argue with you. And he just wailed. And it was great. And then she comes out in this stupid outfit, and he shifts the song automatically to show how he felt about it. He went right into the Beverly Hillbillies theme. And I looked at Liz and I went, Prince is funny.
What might have been when you guys sent that to me, it went to a place, a tipping point when I was 15. And this is a love story, guys. It's a love story. What might have been, let me end first, which is, it could have ended with me in a Michigan mansion married to a turf engineer. That's what might have been. And instead I'm here in Garbage Town. So it ultimately didn't happen, obviously. But could have been the queen of turf. Yes, Matt. I'll always remember this moment. It's one moment in time, and I always think, what might have been? So when I was 15, and we moved a lot. I lived in Pennsylvania. We moved a lot. But we stayed in one area at Downingtown High School, which Miles Teller also went to, guys.
Nice.
So pretty big. Pretty big.
Yeah.
So my tipping point was, I'm a sophomore in high school. I'm pretty unpopular, overweight, sort of the typical fat kid story. But I lived in this neighborhood, this great neighborhood, where obviously this is the time before cell phones, not to date myself too much, but kids were still riding bikes and playing until sunset in the cul-de-sac and just figuring out their own fun. So up the street from me lived these three boys, and it was Dave, Doug, and Dan. I'm not kidding.
The D's.
And they were true heartthrobs. It was like, I keep thinking it was like the movie Wild America. Do you guys remember that? It starred Jonathan Taylor Thomas, Devon Sawa, and Scott Bairstow, and it was right on time. And he was, okay, so Dave was my crush, right?
Yeah.
And he was the oldest, and he was my Scott Bairstow. And he was like a brunette Zach Morris. Mm. He really pulled off like an American Eagle button down with like short sleeves, and he had that like flashy grin. And then he had like, and he was a senior, and I was a sophomore, so unrequited love.
Right.
And then he had two younger brothers, Doug, the middle brother, and the Devon Sawa. Mm-hmm. And then Dan would hang around with us, and he was younger. But anyway, it was like Wild America was living on my street, and I was in love with him. I loved him. He used to pass my locker every day between fourth and fifth period. Backstory, our families...
He stopped time by talking to the camera.
He stopped time. I mean, it was like
a
slow motion. Yeah, it was his skill was making me die inside. That was his skill. Like, and now backstory too, our families were friends. Our moms were good friends. So we would go on trips together in the neighborhood. Like we'd go to Seaside Heights, New Jersey.
Nice.
Another garbage town.
Classy.
But like a true garbage town.
Yeah.
And so we were always hanging out. And Dave also, he was like one of those cool guys. His dad worked for GM. So he had like a rotating garage of cars. Like he was always driving to school in like a new car. Like he had like the newest Bronco. It was like dating a Maserati dealer. You know, it's like, but like the Pennsylvania version. So basically what happened is we had gone on a beach trip, two families together in a Suburban, which his dad got us on loan.
Yeah.
Right. Pretty sweet.
Yeah.
And that weekend he had come up with a nickname for me, which... I think at the time, and I was trying to remember today, I think it was Raquel because it was a play on my middle name, which is Renee, which everyone always said was trashy, right?
Aww.
I know, but it didn't matter because he had come up with a nickname for me. It didn't matter.
Right.
We were clearly meant to be. Like he paid
sign.
Attention.
This is like the girl sign.
I was like, I'm going to ask him out. I'm going to do it. And this was a big deal because he was giving me attention. He drove me home that week on my own. So I was like, oh God, I'm in. This is happening. So... this is in stark contrast to what was happening in my life really in high school, which was the only love I was getting in high school was from the kid whose locker was literally next to mine. And he was kind of bulky, like just shapes, you know, and like the worst thing about him was he had, and this comes into play, he had the worst body odor. You know how kids like hit like 14 or 15 boys in particular and they hit puberty. And
all the smells.
And all the smells.
Girls, too.
Girls, too.
Yeah.
There's a faint smell.
It's weird.
Yeah, right? Okay, so you know, there's like there's a smell, right?
It's just a face.
It's just a face. But Scott was super pungent to the point where like people knew that about him. It was like, and it was like a sharp odor, like a cheddar, you know, like it was like so.
Like, did they call him Cheddar Scott?
Like cheddar, like body cheddar, you know? And our lockers were next to each other.
Yeah.
We sat next to each other in homeroom. And he was super into me. And at the time, the Marcy Playground song came out, Sex and Candy. Do you guys remember
right,
that song?
Yeah.
And he would sing it, I Love Leck and Candy. And I wanted to die every time.
Be more like sex and cheese with him.
Yes, right? It was, which is all of your dreams when you're a sophomore. But he was a sweet guy, but it was not right. So, right.
Shrewd. Because if the pits are that bad, imagine what the undercarriage is like.
I know, right? Oof. And Scott also sported a button down, but not in the same way.
Yeah.
You know? And he was in the same, I remember he was in the same Eagle Scout troop as Dave, but like Dave to me for his like Eagle Scout finishing project had like built a bench for the elderly, and I was like, oh my God, he's like Jesus, he's a carpenter, you know, like he does all the right things. Scott ate a bench. He was garbage. So these were the two like love things happening in my life. Basically it comes down to this moment. This beach trip has happened. He drove me home one night. That next Monday, I'd spent all weekend like priming myself. I'm like, between fourth and fifth period, I'm going for it. So fourth and fifth period, the bell rings. I like practice my like casual lean on my locker. You know, like I was like, just taking it out of my locker, you know. The bell rings. Dave rounds the corner. And I swear it was like Dreamweaver. Like it was just like, such a big smile. And he had a perfect, I remember the blue plaid button down. And I was like, this is
I see Apatow directing this scene.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Just like the wind blowing.
I mean, it might as well have been.
Yeah.
So he turns the corner. He smiles at me. And normally he would just keep walking, but not today. Today he starts to head towards me. And I was like, this is a sign. I start to head towards him. I smile. We connect. And then I hear, "I love Leckin' Candy," and a cheddar arm drapes across my shoulder. And I was just like, no. And I saw Dave, like, I saw his nose wrinkle, and I saw him turn and go down the other way. And I was just, I turned and I looked at Scott and I was like, "You ruined this," and just walked off.
Poor Scott.
Poor guy never knew what happened to him, I don't think.
He put a stink cloak on
you. He did. I think he marked me for life. I think it's now like served as a metaphor for other things in my life. I've been marked. But so that was my moment where I was like, what could have been.
Oh, yeah.
Young love,
that
guys.
Moment was...
I mean, somewhere there is like we often say, there is another podcast where poor Cheddar Scott is talking
body
about
Cheddar, how, yeah.
Yeah, body Cheddar is so tortured about what happened to him in high school.
Right.
But so Dave ended up being like the
now,
turf king of...
Right. Well, first, as if it's not worse, he like manufactured helicopter parts for like ambulance helicopters, and I was like, oh, God, it's like benches in the air. You know? It's like... we reconnect on Facebook. Our families are still friends. Like now, I think if you heard this, I've told this story to him. This took me like years. I think he came out to visit. He was visiting an aunt out here, and I was just like, you know, I just want to let you know that Scott got in the way of our love.
But
he's
married.
He's married. He's like happily married. I don't know if he has kids or not.
Do we know what happened to Cheddar Arm?
Now,
or body
Scott,
cheddar?
Interestingly enough, 2 years into me living in LA, contacted me on Facebook, and we had dinner. He is lovely.
Yep.
He no longer smells like cheddar.
That's
he's,
funny.
I believe he's an animator.
You're
which
right.
Makes sense.
In a parallel universe, his podcast begins with him explaining the medical terminology for his odor problem.
Yeah. Right.
Like how he couldn't help it and, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
And people teased him and it's years of therapy, which is totally true. Like everybody comes out of high school wounded. I don't care who you are.
Right. Exactly.
He discovered having a pastrami sandwich strapped underneath each arm
was
problematic.
It was not what women wanted.
Right.
But, you know, you have to experiment. That's how you learn. That's how you learn.
Yeah.
So I always think, what might have been? Yeah. Mansion in Michigan. Turf engineer.
There's a lot of wealth in Michigan, and you might have been part of it.
And now I'm here.
And you're here, yeah. And what'd you call it? Shit town?
Garbage town.
Garbage town, yeah.
That is a popular phrase these days. Yeah. Garbage town, garbage people.
Yeah.
I believe
Erica Rivenoia coined it.
People have been bringing back Bullet Train to Fuck Town, too.
That's awesome.
Which is...
See, now, I censored
amazing.
My fuck earlier because I was worried we couldn't swear.
This is a zone where all the words go. So everything goes. What would you say now to Scott?
If he had draped that arm on me now, I'd turn it in and be like, things are going to get better. Maybe not for you, but probably for me. And that's... No, I'm just kidding. I would just be like... I'd be like... Look,
that'd be worse than what you actually said.
It's way worse. I think I would just be like, it's going to get okay, buddy. You know, it's not me, but it'll be okay.
And if you ever touch me when he's near again, I will rip your arm off.
Well, the worst part is that I remember my shirt smelling all day.
God.
Oh, that was definitely a medical condition.
My older brother had that same thing, and he would steal my shirts, and I would get mad because he would hang them back up in my closet, right? I'd go to put that shirt on, I'd be like, oh! Because there's nothing smelled like
right.
that. Like his freshly pubescent armpits as they were trying to figure out how to smell.
Right.
Chose the worst possible smell imaginable.
Yeah. I love that he thought hanging them in the closet, he's like, I'll disguise this. He'll never know.
He'll never know I wore this.
Yeah.
People that smell don't seem to understand that they smell.
I know. Isn't that weird?
It, people are saying to their face, you stink, you stink.
Yeah, like, it's time to deodorize.
Yeah, what's...
There's actually a medical reason for it that I found the other day, which is that it's your own body. So your body is trained to like it and recognize it as sweet smelling. It's really twisted. Look it up. It's on the internet.
So Scott's like
me.
The sweetest guy. I know. Now I'm worried.
I think that I smell good, but I maybe smell
right.
horrible.
You think you smell good, and so you don't understand, like...
Matt,
if you
smell
stand,
me.
Yeah. If you stand in a corner and let one drop, and you think, that's okay. That just smells like the room. Everybody knows.
Oh, my God.
Good luck getting to sleep tonight.
Yeah.
If you had a chance, like if you were Mr. Destiny and you got a chance to go back... and do it all again. Would you trade your experience out here in garbage LA land for being the turf queen of, what was it, Michigan?
Maybe. Who knows, right? It's like sliding doors. It's like, I mean, what does that look like? He was so good looking. It was so past my league that I was just like, the fact that he was paying attention to me, I don't know. I mean,
you
maybe.
Could have pulled it off.
What maybe. About prom, Blaine?
I know. Well, that's what I mean. I think what I would have done is I wouldn't have reacted so poorly to Scott. Yeah. Poor Scott, right? And I would have just been like, I'm going to need you to stay here, Scott. I'm moving on. And I would have walked towards Dave and walked down the hallway with him. And who knows?
Yo. Say cheese.
Mr. Cheeseman. Give you all you need, man. Cheeseman.
That's it, ladies. Now chill.
Story about one young little girl who grew up in Park Slope, Brooklyn. It was just sort of like a perfect place that was still affordable for parents to raise their kid, and it had the benefit of having an amazing elementary school right in the center of the main avenue, and it was just perfect urban living, and I was lucky enough to live there. Our house was like the last house before the crack den where people would call up to the lady like, hey, mama. Yeah. You know, so we were right on the line. Much like our neighborhood, I also rode the line. If you're looking at the playground, like there were super popular kids. And then there were like the, you know, the invisible kids like Cheddar Scott. So I'm just going to call him Scott because I'm reinforcing his high school trauma.
Yeah, you're
so
just
Scott, making it worse. Dignified, amazing, all grown up Scott. And so like me and my friends were kind of like floating in the amorphous middle. Like, we had each other, but we did not have over here on the high end of the scale. So I did have two good friends, and the first one was named Anne, and she was a funny, super smart bookworm. She was the girl that had the Nintendo in her house. They had a pantry full of amazing things that were like not in my house, and she and I were, we used to walk around the hallways of our elementary school like just bumping into things because we were reading books. And
geek. Yeah, I was say, super cool.
Exactly. Yeah. And then
so dating a lot.
Yeah, so dating a lot.
Cool.
So then there was my friend Claire, and she was just this like Irish firecracker with this blonde hair and this mouth that just like crashed into a huge grin that was wicked, and she was a fast talker, and like when I look back at her, I don't see a fifth grader or a fourth grader, I see a 30-year-old. Like, yeah. we just had that friendship. So I loved both of them. We used to have fun, and we used to watch Airplane together, eating Entenmann's donut. It was like, for being like in the amorphous middle between popular and invisible, it was a good life. And then the other thing I did was 2 days a week I went to an after school center at a Jewish temple, Temple Beth Elohim, on Garfield Place. And
I went to the Y.
Yeah, right.
Same.
Right.
Same.
And yep. It was great. Like, they had arts classes. They had a guy, one of the girls' fathers used to come in and play Golden Oldies on the piano for us. So, like, we learned, like, who put the bump in the bump, shabomb, shabomb. Like, we learned.
So he was unemployed.
Yeah.
I was going to say it at the Y.
Paul at the bar was a friend of his. Like,
and at the Y, our stereo was stolen. Right. And we reassembled the furniture we sat on. The activities were similar.
It was idyllic. I'll put it that way. And one of the things that we did at this thing was plays. And like, we did Wind in the Willows in fourth grade, which was about as boring a play as you could possibly do. And all my friends were in that. So by the fifth grade, like, none of my friends were interested in auditioning for
Calcutta. Was
Oh, Calcutta. Right here. We did all the good ones. And fifth grade,
Rent.
At the after school center, the play was going to be, this is 1989, pre-Rent. Rent was happening.
Well, right. What's the deal with Rent?
Oh, God.
I watched
Rent
it. I was like,
girls.
Hey, you're fucking Rent.
Yeah.
What the hell?
Get over it.
What's a Rent? He wants a
Get a job.
Like, what makes you think you don't have to pay
What's
your rent?
Problem? Yeah.
I had such a problem
this
with it.
This play is based on a false premise.
Yeah.
So
I'm a tranny. I don't have to pay my rent.
Just
yeah, you
work.
Do.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the play this year in the fifth grade at the After School Center was Really Rosie.
Oh.
Yeah. And for those of you who may not know, Really Rosie's a musical that was based on a bunch of books by Maurice Sendak, and it was composed by Carole King. It's a classic, like, feel good, kids.
Never heard of that.
It's a
oh, it's
great
so good.
Musical.
And way better than Rent. Way better.
It's better than Rent. It's proto-Rent. It's about kids in like, deepest Brooklyn. It's basically a story about a little bossy girl who sings and dances and orders everybody in her neighborhood around, and, like, she's just the star of her world. And I don't even think she learns any lessons. Like, she just continues to be the star of her world. And I mentioned this is a musical. So I have never sung in my life. I'm not a singer. I'm not a known singer. But I try
Jewel.
Out. Yeah, right. I mean, I'm living in a van, you know. So I try out anyway. Now, I just want to interrupt this for a second and say, like, in the years since, I have met many Really Rosies and many people who have played this role. Did you? Are you a Really Rosie?
I was in it, but I wasn't her.
Oh, see.
I can't.
You know,
either.
We know. You and I know a Really Rosie in common. Mm-hmm. We actually know one. Really Rosie's line, the opening line, the curtains open. I'm standing there in like a long red dress. The first line in the play is, "Hello, my name is Rosie and I'm perfect and wonderful and everybody loves me and wants to be me and who can blame them?" And then she like launches into song. And my first line of my play would have been like, "Hello, I'm Jenny. Can I take your coat? Oh, am I in the way? I'll go over here." So like, it was not a natural progression. But who knew I got the part?
Yay!
I got the lead. I was a fifth grader. Everybody else was a fourth grader.
You're who Rosie should be. It's right. Her self-perception, not... Right. Like, yeah. You know what I mean?
Like, it's about who Rosie is inside.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
not that you weren't a looker, right?
Right. No, it was my high point moment. It was a high point moment. We rehearsed. We did the whole thing. And opening night, there's my mom sitting in the audience. And the curtain opens. And she looks at me. And I burst into song. And she's like, "Oh my God, my daughter can sing."
Oh,
because nobody knew that actually had, for fifth grade, I had a voice. And like the play went great. And like the little girls that played, like there was a little girl that played a girl named Kathy in the play and her name was Amber. And there was a little girl with black curly hair, super tomboyish, named Emily. And she played Alligator, who's this kid that wears like a little alligator thing on his head. And there's all this like intrigue, and they loved it. They were so happy to be in this play. It was so well received that they wanted to bring it to
our elementary school.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I like
traveling show.
Yeah, they wanted to like take it
multiple
to the main
engagements
stage.
Traveling to your where things are more uncomfortable.
Yeah.
It's like you went off Broadway to Broadway.
Yeah.
That's
and so
it,
only Broadway's even meaner.
Yeah. Right. This is a public elementary school
already.
In Brooklyn where I got chased yeah. home from school. So yeah. I have to confront the idea that I have to, as the fifth grader, like convince all the teachers and do all the things, and like I the first possible moment I bail. I don't commit to the notion of bringing Really Rosie to the main stage.
No.
I know.
I don't blame you, actually. I totally get it.
Self-preservation, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And
you're
so,
at that age, too, where it's
right,
like you're
fifth
thinking
grade,
more
like,
about
I
that.
Knew, and like they had a nice fourth grade. There were good kids in their fourth grade, and my fifth grade was like just filled with like, I didn't
haters.
Even, yeah, like future terrorists. I don't know. So, emotional terrorists.
Really
like
Rosie.
White, rich, emotional terrorists.
Really Rosie
like,
would become Rosie Palmer instantly.
Yeah, like I would have got stuff thrown at me. Like, I had all these reasons. But, like,
just me yelling,
like,
"You ruined it!"
You know, and poor Emily and Amber, like, they're bummed. But what can you do? There's no Really Rosie without Rosie. So, fast forward 24 years. My husband Matt is working for a show that is run by his friend from college, Hillary.
Bad teacher.
Yes. And
which was called Really Rosie.
Which was called Really Rosie. It seems
that is so
the
weird.
Same thing.
Ari
like a very confident, like,
oh my God, it is the same thing.
It's the same thing. So in the middle of doing this show, Hillary Winston, she's also getting married. So there's a bachelorette party, and the girls who are planning the bachelorette party decide that the super most logical thing to do is to have my husband, Matt, be the entertainment for the bachelorette party.
I remember this.
So I'm not going to tell the whole story because the whole story is available to you in Playboy magazine, courtesy of Ms. Winston.
And it ends with Matt whipping it out?
No. So
that's
Matt,
how
the
tonight
bottom
ends.
Line is, are we okay?
Yeah.
Okay. The bottom line is that Matt's job was to wear a full mustache that he grew for the occasion, a tearaway policeman's outfit, and underneath it, a historically significant gold spandex suit. And he was going to do a mock ironic dance to Ginuwine's Pony at some super fancy hotel lounge by the beach in Santa Monica. And then he ended up doing the whole bit in the hotel room. He burst out of the closet. It was fantastic. And I came in at the end and was like, because like I was a wife. I like was there to support him. I was like hiding in the bushes. Really, like, amazing. So I burst in there at the
you
end
were
of this.
Pathetic.
Yeah, I was
yes, you were. I heard it too.
I was referring to myself in this point of me hiding in the bushes, a fully
but that
professional.
Was the objective. Right?
Yeah, 38-year-old woman
what
hiding in the bushes.
What else could the objective be? Success meant
like,
pathetic.
Yeah.
And so I burst in there and like, oh, there's all these girls and they're a little inebriated and they're laughing their ass off. And there's one girl sitting in the corner and she has this long black hair, and she's like a little stunned. And I'm like, well, why is she stunned? I can't quite figure it out. And it turns out, I find out not too long later, that the reason she's stunned is because she's seeing a ghost. She's seeing the ghost of Really Rosie. Because it
Stop.
Turns out that Hillary is marrying a guy from Park Slope, Brooklyn, and his sister is named Emily.
What?
What?
And she was Alligator in Really Rosie.
It's no.
It's a small world, after all. That's a small, small world.
Oh, my God.
I mean, it boggled my mind. So, of course, we went down to Austin for this wedding, and we talked, and she was like, oh, my God. We had the whole reunion, and she was like, I wish we had done this thing.
What might have been?
What might have been? And it got me thinking. And so, no joke. This past weekend, I was in New York for a memorial service, and then after that, I went out to Brooklyn because every 5 years or so, I go back to Park Slope. I walk down 7th Avenue. I'm like, what might have been here? And so I'm a very nostalgic, overthinking girl. And I pass by, and instead of being like locked up on a weekend, as it should be, it is alive. There is a weekend carnival. And I look at this place, and I'm just, like, overcome, like, remembering, like, you know, my best friend Anne, we're no longer really super close friends. Like, I see her on Facebook. I keep tabs. Right. I don't know where Claire is at all. Claire has disappeared. She is not on the social graph.
She's like D-Day from Animal House.
Yeah. Like, it's not even that far off. Like, I have not spoken to her since, like, maybe, like, sixth grade. We lost touch after we graduated elementary school because I went to a private school. She went to a public school. The weird thing is, like, my friends, you know that thing when you, like, totally lose touch with people and then all of a sudden you're giving money to their, like, memorial bench? Like, that has happened to me more times than is, like, awesome to admit.
One that Dave built.
Yeah.
Dave
built it.
And I think that Claire went the same public Y I did.
Right.
We were at the Y together.
Right.
Rebuilding
and
our couches.
It's just like that.
For the last break.
Every once in a while you have that weird worry, like, where is Claire?
Oh, God, I hope I don't see a bench.
So I go in, and I'm in my elementary school, and I'm walking around, and I'm just, like, totally overwhelmed because the kindergarten rooms are tiny, and the cafeteria smells the same, and the gym where Mr. Polsky used to just torture us into submission is, like, so tiny. I can hardly even imagine that little
like literally
kids...
literally?
Well, very close. Like, very close on the line.
Matters.
Like, you know how the United States government defines torture in a particular way? He was just on the legal side of that. So
gym teachers.
Gym before
teachers
regulation.
Mr. Polsky. Oh my God.
Yeah.
So I go into the auditorium and I am just bowled over because here I am where it all almost happened. And I think about the fact that, like, what if I had pushed through and been a totally different person and, like, owned Really Rosie and ended up putting on this production and everybody would have seen, like, that moment where they all suddenly see Ione Skye in a totally different way and be like, it would have been so nice to be friends with you and say anything.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
the whole deal. And I'm just like, would that have affected me in any part of my future life where I ended up mostly being behind the scenes because that seemed safer? And I, you know, is there a moment in, right, Fred's already ready to be like, no, come on.
Because there's no, you can't do logic like that. And it's not like in the movies with real elementary school kids.
Right.
They're pricks.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Right.
Yeah. No matter how good it was, they would have been a shithead.
Right. And so but that moment of just like, it wouldn't, because in improv, the whole point is you're not supposed to try for a good performance. You're just supposed to get up there and do it.
Right.
And so what if I had learned that lesson in fifth grade instead of, I don't know, at 38 or 2 weeks ago? I mean, that's what it is to me. It's not like external, like, love. It's like, what would have happened if I just committed? I mean, I'm married to Mr. 100% commitment here, 120.
Yeah.
And so it was an interesting, terrifying, overwhelming moment. And I immediately fled the theater and I'm walking down the hallway and I'm just like looking for anything to take this moment away from me. And I see this long billboard of, like, you know, here are the janitors and here's the PTA people.
Biggest quitters in school history.
Yeah.
There's a poster of you.
Right, picture of me. It's like, is this titled If You Can't Do Teach?
And I'm
like,
walking along.
What?
And I'm walking along and I see the kindergarten teachers. And I see a picture of this blonde girl with this giant grin. And I swear to God, I almost burst into tears in the hallway because it's Claire.
Oh, my God.
It's my best friend from fifth grade who I could not find in the entire social media universe. And here's her picture.
She's
up on the wall.
A teacher?
She's a
there.
Kindergarten teacher at our elementary school.
What?
And I'm thinking, like, all right, I need to go find Claire because the universe is telling me I just found my old best friend from fifth grade.
Yeah.
And I was like, but wait a second. what am I going to do? What if I start sobbing? Like, because this is so overwhelming for me. But she just means by like, nice.
Chicks do that.
Chicks do that, right?
We're so emotional.
And I was meeting like another friend, so I didn't want to be like, hi, great, huge emotional moment. Gotta run.
Right. Yeah.
Right? And so...
Great to see you, bye.
Right. And so I did not go find Claire, but like just the knowledge that I knew where she was in some way corrected the arc of the universe for me. You know, because now I know where she is. Now I know she's doing good. She's smiling. She's happy. Like she is mapped again. And so
she does nap time.
She does nap time.
Finger painting.
I mean, I cannot think of a more perfect teacher. I would want her as my teacher. And so it just made me so happy, and it somehow just clicked something into place, like the worry that I had. I don't know if there's like a nice wrapped up story structure third act moment of lesson about what it meant to be really Rosie and what it would have meant to do this thing, but I really just think the answer is, if really Rosie for 20 years was like curled up in some corner of my brain, like shivering with her little fur stole wrapped around her.
Why didn't you let me shine?
Yeah. Like at least at this point, she's now awake and someone is feeding her soup. Right? So at the very least, there's that.
Overdosey Rosie, you're like some kind of poisonous fruit. Overdosey Rosie, with your long hair. I don't want nobody but you. Overdosey Rosie, I guess this isn't so very new.
A lot of problems, you know, and then listen to your guys' podcast and try to figure out. You can take it two different ways. If you hear what might have been, it can be either a positive or a negative. Like, if I hadn't done this, what might have been would have been dark, right? Or, if I'd have just done that, what might have been? You hear the inflection. It's like either, you know, dark or light. But to me, the spirit of it is the light. Ah, if I just had that moment.
Turf engineer.
Yeah, what might have been? It could have been great.
You know, yeah.
That didn't really start to succeed in my craft until I was about 40, but I had committed to it until then. I started as a PA, but I've had breaks, so I've always made the decision at a certain point that led me to go, oh, good, because if I hadn't done that, hey, what might have been, right? You know, and I, too, was a geek and made fun of.
I mean, nobody here isn't. I suppose they are, but maybe they're just development executives.
But it was bad. Like, you know. And
but it's like jokes on you, jocks.
Yeah,
right. We're doing just fine.
Yeah, no. My brother was worse off. His teeth were so bucked, he'd eat an apple through a cross-link fence, right? And the kids, I mean, he was horrible. And we had no money for braces. Right. It was a terrible thing. So in a way, my story kind of parallels that. I was 2.5 years old when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. Mm. I'm very political. I'm a massive lefty. I post things on my Facebook page that just, I've got a few thousand people there, and I always forget that half of them are Republican. Those are usually the ones that would hire me potentially, you know.
Right.
So, you know, I went that way with this topic. I thought, let's do my biggest one, which is, what if JFK hadn't been assassinated? What would have been? What the country would have been, and more importantly, what I would have been? This could have affected my life, too, because I think it all the way through. You know, the funny thing is he was a playboy, and he was kind of it wasn't supposed to be him, it was supposed to be Joe, right? Yeah. And Joe dies in the war, so then it's him. So I think at first he was kind of like, yeah, of course. Like, but then he heard Camelot, like the press makes up this Camelot thing, and he wasn't that. I mean, he was banging chicks in the Lincoln bedroom, and like, he wasn't honorable, you know what I mean? But he was becoming honorable. He was hearing all that Camelot stuff and seeing what was happening to the country based off of the fact that they had this young, cool president, beautiful wife, children in the White House, and he bought into it, and I believe he began to correct, and then he was killed. So if he hadn't been, he would have completed his first term within the next year, and he would have gotten a second term because everybody loved him, you know. And he, I think, in his second term, you know, the guy who created, you know, the Peace Corps, and I mean, he was thinking in terms of civil rights, and like, so we would have been going in that direction. The Vietnam War would have de-escalated and ended because he didn't care. This is all these assassination theories on him too. Like, maybe the powers that be, that, you know, the real lefties say that we took over the heroin trade from the French, and that's why we were in Vietnam in the first place,
oh my
and went
God.
Into Cambodia. because that's where all the poppy fields were, right? So I don't know if that's true. It gets very twisted and dark, but I mean, I think that he saw that it was a no-win situation, had a second thought about it, and started to... So how this applies to me is, in 68, Bobby would have won, because it would have been this great two terms. But in 68, when Nixon won, my already drunken, borderline abusive stepfather... who was a carpenter, big union guy, big Democrat. So when Nixon came in, he went, that it was his tipping point. Things got worse for him based off of Nixon coming in. His drinking became worse, and he became very abusive. So my life went into a direction that I don't think it would have if the country was really on this, it, just pursuing this whole Camelot thing.
If the worldview of the country had continued to support your stepfather.
Yeah, the working man.
Yeah.
And because it didn't. From my perspective, we would have been much more of a country of the people. We would have been a lot more giving. There would have been a lot more programs that helped the poor. 17 million kids that go to bed hungry each night in this country, it wouldn't exist. You know what I mean? Like, we'd make sure that that didn't happen. You know, so, you know, I would have been more gregarious. Like, I became closed.
Right.
And I was like you. I was closed and I was quiet in school. And I think that maybe, because I knew I wanted to be an actor and I had a ventriloquist dummy and I wanted to do those things. But, you know, you have this oppressed household where right. the stepfather feels bad about himself. So he needs to make you feel bad about you. You, and
right.
It just became a thing that held me back, you know what I mean? So in the end, I persevered, and I think that I've succeeded in life because I felt like, you know, pointing a finger at him and going, so, yeah, people do want to see me.
Right.
Not a lot, because they get the shit, you know, I get canceled every time. But
everybody gets canceled.
But, you know, he would be like,
canceled.
What makes you think you'd be on TV? Like, right. What makes you think you're that great? You know, like, and so it's, in a way, I fought to do it in spite of him, you know, because... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you're always fighting the ghosts.
Yeah.
When you're like totally independent and totally free of them, they're all still there.
Yeah.
They're all still there.
Oh yeah, he's definitely he's passed away, but I feel bad for him too. Like he was just burdened, you know.
Yeah.
And I don't think it wouldn't have been that way if Kennedy wasn't assassinated, because Bobby would have done two terms.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully Bobby would have been the guy that he would have been if he hadn't been killed at the ambassador.
How did your stepfather perceive that Nixon and all subsequent Republicans were bad for him?
Nixon was not pro-union. The biggest injection of money into the Democratic Party is unions. So if you can bust the unions, the people with really big money, it's hard to get them to the Democrats because the Democrats want to take more of their money.
Right.
So it's just all about money, isn't it?
Right. But in terms of your stepfather, like, did he... Was it immediate? Like, Nixon's elected, this country's going to shit.
Oh, yeah. He's, I remember my aunt, his sister, she married a guy who owned an auto parts place, and then a string of them. He had money, right? And so he was a Republican, and I heard them get into the biggest fight, and he was knowledgeable for, you know, being a drunk, out-of-work carpenter. I mean, he knew why it was that it would be bad for him that Nixon got in, and he probably placed too much importance on it, as I tend to place too much importance.
Like a fixation, like a focal point for all the...
Yeah, it was like that's probably it. I think that he saw it as like he was on the outs, and that if Humphrey could win, you know, but if it was Bobby, like if Bobby won, he probably would have been, there would have been a real reason to root for Bobby over Nixon.
Right.
Nixon wouldn't have, you know, I mean, Nixon would have run in 68 because he's a horse's ass, but there's no way he would have beat Bobby. Look at the two of them, you know,
yeah.
Bobby was
yeah.
the one, like Bobby was better than John, I think, overall. He would have been president, I'm sure. So.
As a kid, were you aware of this? Like, did you have these feelings as a kid? Or
I was rooting for Humphrey because I didn't want him to fly off the handle. And I could see how invested he was.
Mm.
So, you know, when Nixon won, I was just like, oh, God. And then things got dark. They got really bad. You know, so I ended up going out to live with my dad when I was 12. And, you know, I was liberated from that. But for 4 years, I was... I just became more and more within myself because it was that, you know, poking the sleeping bear thing. Like you don't want to get him mad, but it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how careful you are.
Could have been the guy down the street.
He's going to wake up and think you took his bottle and then, you know, throw a boot at your head. Or, you know, it was hey, this is hilarious, huh, kids?
Well, no, but like...
Fred did a fun podcast, didn't he?
Did you come out here to California, or where did you?
My dad had made it. They divorced when I was two, and my mom actually left him. They were so young, and he was working three jobs to try to make it work. And she's like, "All you do is work. I want to get laid." Like, so, she just took off, and she was 19 when she had me, and 17 when she had my brother. So he went out to California, started picking oranges, and made his way up to being the CEO of Super Shuttle, actually. So
wow.
It was a different life out here. I had the opportunity. We were in Redondo Beach, and I looked at Hollywood, and I said, "This is my destiny."
Right. Was it? I'm always interested in the effect of improv on shy people.
Right.
Is that the thing? Like, what was the thing that was like, all right, it's okay, I can.
I found improv as a technique because I was going to be a theater actor, right. And I did Viola Spolin's technique, and that's improvisation as a acting technique. It's applied to the written word.
Right.
I mean, it's how you prep. So I went to the Comedy Store when I was 18, because my dad was like, well, see ya.
Right.
What are you still doing here?
You're an adult now.
I moved to Hollywood and started turning tricks. No, I'm kidding. But
everybody got a dream. What's your dream?
It was a tough town, but I would sneak into the Comedy Store, and I watched Robin Williams and Cynthia Sighetti, Martin Short, Taylor Negron. They were the Comedy Store players, and they were doing improv, and I had to sneak in to get to see them because I was not 21. It was a bar, so I'd go into the kitchen at 6 and I'd hide in the corners and I'd watch them play, and that motivated me. That's kind of when I really started to come out. I mean, in the drama department in high school, I was the guy.
Right.
But I was still kind of ashamed of the fact that my notoriety came from being in the drama, because it was South High School, it was a surfer school, right? In Redondo Beach, they're like, we were a bunch of fags, and it's like,
right.
Whatever the definition of the word was, I assumed it meant that they thought I sucked people's penises.
Right, because of the theater.
Because I was an actor,
yeah.
So we were outcasts, and I was always trying to change that or shift it. I always felt the other, like outside. So
Did I see a picture of you with Robin Williams?
Yes, I had the opportunity to direct him in the Crazy Ones.
Oh my God.
And I sat at the, I first saw him at the table read. And I said, listen, I'm going to get this fan thing out of the way quick, because you need to know that you mentored me without ever knowing it. Like, I told him the whole story of the Comedy Store. And I have a moment where I was in the entry-level group at the Comedy Store, the potluck players, right?
Right?
And that's how they decided who might make their way up in the ranks. And we were doing a herald, right? So there's a big line, and I grab who I think is my buddy, right? But Robin was like, doing blow backstage. He did that stuff to equalize, right? He was just, because he's had such issues, but he had pushed my buddy aside and replaced him.
Oh, no.
And there was a ripple around the audience that I didn't pay any attention
ripple.
To. I thought
the
they were excited to see my next scene. I grab him, who I think is Darren, I pull him out. So we both come out, and I'm about to start the scene, and I look at him, and I was the guy walking around school with the suspenders and the Nanu,
oh,
like, it was Robin Williams. I to my credit, maybe a beat I lost, but then I went, hey, my long lost brother, I haven't seen you in 30 years.
Oh.
And he goes, pretty strange since we're both 18. I'm stunned, and the audience roars because the laugh is because I'm stunned.
Yeah.
And as I'm walking away, I'm like, Robin cheated. Robin broke the rules of improv. Robin broke the rules
always
of improv.
Always yes and. Always yes and. Yeah.
And he walked up to me and said, sorry about that. Anything for the laugh. And that's it. That's all. And it really was a real eye opener, because it's true. That's what it's all about. Fuck the rules. You need to know the rules because you got to break the rules.
Yeah.
But you got to know them first. Yeah.
Oh.
So,
do you still have the ventriloquist dummy?
I don't have the original one, but I keep replacing him. It's funny because I called him Jimmy Nelson because I read the box wrong. I read the box wrong. He was actually Danny O'Day, and the ventriloquist was Jimmy Nelson.
Nice.
So I thought the dummy's, so he was Jimmy, and I had him say just horrid things to people because I couldn't express myself.
Yeah.
So. I would take him to school, and I'd be like, nice tits, like.
The classic ventriloquist thing was like, you couldn't say.
I could say what I couldn't say through him. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
Yeah, it was, so in with the what might have been, I think that overall, I look at the I think that I would have maybe succeeded faster than 40. I had a lot of demons and things that I had to work through based off of my childhood, you know. But I think that, I just think that we would have been, I don't think we would have had Reagan either. Hmm. Jimmy Carter may not have had, who knows what's going to happen after 76, but I had it all locked up with Bobby Kennedy up to 76. And because we would have taken it back all those years of, you know, with none of the, like the counterculture would have just been fun. Like it would have just been like, hey, remember the hippies? Those guys that just like fucked with gay abandon and did drugs. The political thing would have come into play because there'd be no war, right? So they would have just kept having fun and going to dead shows. Yeah. And you know, it would have been a time. It would have occurred, you know, but it wouldn't have gotten ugly like it did.
So now, let me ask you a question. Have you read Stephen King's 11/1963?
Oh, the best book ever.
No. Okay, maybe don't. Maybe don't.
Is that if it hadn't happened?
No, I believe that you should read it. I think you should read it.
Right. But
I've walked Dealey Plaza. I was obsessed with his
assassination. I will say no more other than to say that Stephen King... tells a whole story about a guy who goes back in time with the intent purpose of trying to stop that assassination.
Yeah.
And other than that, I will say no more, except you probably should read it.
Is there a possessed St. Bernard? Or a magic car that
tries
to kill you?
It's really quite a sophisticated haunting. Like, everybody gives Stephen King such a rap, right?
I think that would be a book. Most prolific writer and always compelling.
Always. Yeah. I think that would be a book for you because it certainly ends up taking a position on what would have happened.
Do you know who's going to be the lead in that? James Franco. It's a J.J. Abrams project.
It's going to
Hulu.
What isn't a J.J. Abrams project?
Isn't James Franco in?
Yeah. Also weird, I know.
But it's
a great book. It is a great book. That's a great what might have been book.
Yeah, it really is. Mm-hmm. It really is.
It's a good one. It's bigger than, it's easy to apply to my story, but I often think of that because I love the country, but I kind of can't stand what's happening. You know, the direction we keep going in is just kind of... weird to me, and we just haven't gotten the breaks over the years. And the Democrats, it's not like I'm a Democrat either. I think that they're...
Well, at this point, those two parties are so...
Yeah, I've almost fallen out completely because it just doesn't matter what, you know, the people... It's actually, we're corporatist. We're not Democrat.
Right, and that's the other thing is I really do think that
money
there's
talks.
Always a reaction to too much of anything in America, and I do feel like maybe after Kennedy it would have roared back Republican because all sorts of things came out of the 60s that weren't
right. Hard to say. I mean, we just with the mentality of the Peace Corps and how they were of the people, I just, like I said, I think ultimately at this point we wouldn't be in question of whether or not you help people.
Why is that still a question?
And when Lyndon Johnson wouldn't have had to do the health care bill or civil rights because Bobby, you know, the baton would have been, and they would have gotten rid of Hoover.
Right.
So the whole like spying on people thing and dressing in ladies' clothes, wasn't that Hoover's thing?
So I guess my question is like, what impact would have either Kennedy brother or Hubert Humphrey had on Cheddar Scott?
I guess that's a great question because I think there would have been more room for Cheddar Scott socially.
A kinder world would have allowed.
Now we make fun. I make fun of Cheddar Scott, but I bet you anything, Cheddar Scott is doing better than all of us.
Sure, absolutely.
I'm sure that secretly he's.
I mean, this is a town full of garbage people, and he's not in this town.
He's not a garbage.
Yeah.
What you didn't realize at the time is that he has a 9-inch. Rigid, disproportionate member.
At the time, I should have bought him.
They call him Yardstick Scott now.
A penis you could overlook the smell for.
Now there's deodorizers for
it. I mean, really, what a girl wouldn't do.
Febreze
that shit is right.
Well, here's to you,
make
Scott,
it work. You make it work.
Giant,
nobody's
giant
perfect.
Cheddar penis.
Nobody's perfect. A giant cheddar penis. Can that be the tagline for this episode?
I mean, it's probably going to be the episode title.
The cheddar penis.
That's what Smegma is, right? Jock cheese.
Yes. See, it all comes together. Yeah. Call back.
Yep. Call back. Yes, and.
In comedy.
You go to the gutter when I came.
I think we all learned a lot here tonight.
I think we all learned. We grew, we learned. We sweated. It was good.
We got personal.
There was some beer.
We got very liberal.
Right. Yeah, very liberal.
We did.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this trip into the alternate timeline of Red, Jenny, and Jackie Black. I think no matter how we all got here, we all ended up pretty much all right.
I will just point out one thing about Scott. I went rooting around for Scott on the internet, and Jackie Vleck, if you want to know what might have been, the guy who draped his arm around you when you were 15 years old went on to win an Oscar. So take that what might have been and smoke it. Anyway, thanks for listening. Special thanks to Alex Cook. And if you want to know more about some of the music we played on this episode, check out the show notes. It came from all across the Creative Commons web. Talk to you next week.